Welcome to Friday. Welcome to yet another rainless week in Seattle, Washington. I'm Bill Radke, and it's time for our week in review. It was yet another week of Seattle's mayor saying he's not going to resign. We have bike share back in Seattle. And if you're not a cyclist, you're a driver, well, your right to use your cell phone's about to shrink. So we're going to discuss all of that and more this hour. We are on Twitter, at KUOW. First, please welcome my panel of super friends, former Attorney General Rob McKenna, Erica C. Barnett, CSForCrank.com, Northwest News Network Managing Editor Phyllis Fletcher. Hey, everybody.
Hey, what's up?
Hello.
A lot of stuff is up. I just listed everything that's up.
That's true. Yeah. Sorry.
And there's more stuff, too.
We can all go home now. Thank you. Thank you, though, Bill.
Let's expand. Let's start with a big city mayor in trouble. The Seattle Times reported that a child welfare investigator in Oregon concluded back in the 1980s that Ed Murray had sexually abused his foster son, but no criminal charge was filed, and Murray's saying, "See, the prosecutors didn't pursue it. I'm vindicated." Murray has denied allegations from four different men who say he sexually abused them as teenagers. Erica, City Council member Lorena Gonzalez says if Murray doesn't resign by Monday, the council should form a transition committee. Does that mean impeachment?
Well, I think it would have to mean impeachment unless something has come out that I don't know about. The city charter says that mayors can be impeached for moral turpitude. I think the problem comes in with the fact that he hasn't violated any laws, and that's also part of the city charter. So my the indications that we're getting from the city council right now is they're not going to go that route. I think a lot of this call for impeachment, and you've also heard it from a lot of the city council and mayoral candidates, It reads a little bit like election year grandstanding and to me. And I think, you know, allowing the mayor to serve out the remaining 5 months of his term and allowing the due process to continue if the case, the only sort of extant case that's actually against him in the courts or was against him in the courts, if that comes up again.
It's been dropped.
But the complainant has said that he will bring it up again after at some later point. Who knows if that's true? But if it happens, then we'll see that due process carry out in the courts. And I think that's the appropriate place for it.
Anyone think Murray will resign by this weekend ahead of Lorena Gonzalez's deadline?
I don't think that's likely, especially since, as Erica has pointed out, the civil lawsuit's been suspended at this point.
Yeah.
The events that came out in the newspaper this week happened over 30 years ago, so I don't think there's a question of moral turpitude while serving in office, and I think that probably would be the test, not what happened or may not have happened 3.5 decades ago. So do they want to burn up the next 5 months focusing on whether or not they can force him from office? That doesn't really make sense to me. Now, he may want to consider resigning later if he concludes he's no longer effective in office and he's just too distracted to do his job. That's his decision to make. But is it the best use of the Seattle City Council's time at this point to try to maneuver to force him out? I don't think they have a legal basis for doing so at this point.
And Phyllis, the mayor's basically saying that a resignation would just be a big distraction for the city anyway.
Yeah, people a lot of times use the, either I don't want to be a distraction or I have become a distraction to do what they want, right? Yeah. So if you want to stay, you say it would be distracting if you left. If you don't want the attention from staying anymore, you say it would be distracting if you stayed. So in a certain way, I mean, it seems at this point entirely up to him, you know, ball's in his court, and or the public. If there's public pressure on him, like if everyone in the city just went to City Hall every single day and just sat there and created a bigger distraction than the current one, then maybe something would be different. But
is there any sign that there's
that's not happening right
now? I was going to ask, is anyone seeing public pressure on Ed Murray to do anything different from what he's doing?
I mean, there's definitely public pressure from the people who have never liked him in the first place. And I think that was inevitable. I mean, there were people saying that he should step down, as soon as the scandal broke, including former Mayor Mike McGinn, who is running to take his place again. But I think in terms of a larger public outcry, we really haven't seen the kind of outcry that, like Phyllis is talking about, you know, showing up at City Hall, protests. I think that what we're more likely to see is just sort of watching this administration fizzle out, and hopefully, you know, it won't become such a distraction that he can't achieve some of the things that, you know, he was elected to do, like the housing affordability and livability agenda, like police reform and other priorities he said he's going to focus on for the remaining 5 months of his term.
Erica, were you saying when you talked about election year grandstanding on the part of the mayoral candidates, do you think City Councilmember Gonzalez is grandstanding in some self-serving way?
Oh, I'm not going to walk into that one, Bill. But
well, you seemed skeptical of her claim.
I will say that she is the only City Council member who was out front calling for his resignation. And in response, other city council members like Sally Bagshaw, like Bruce Harrell, said that that would not be appropriate. So it is telling. I mean, it's interesting that it's an election year. On the other hand, Lorena Gonzalez has a very easy path to reelection. So I think it would be going way too far to say it was grandstanding for votes. But I think on the part of some of the mayoral candidates, it certainly looks that way. There were candidates who were either saying that he should not step down before the latest allegations, candidates who were remaining silent, who have come forward with very forceful, very late in the game statements in the last week or so that I think are clearly designed to distinguish themselves from the front runner, Jenny Durkin, who has said that he should not step down.
Yes, Phyllis.
Where I've seen the most, passion around this is just people's private pain. You know, people who feel insulted and hurt and that, you know, kind of wanting to brush it under the rug or just kind of leave it alone, let him stay in office. Like, that's personally hurtful to them, either as people of color or as survivors of abuse. That's how I've seen that expressed. And that's the kind of thing it probably wouldn't manifest in any kind of public protest. But I've seen that be very upsetting to people close to me who identify with that perspective.
Mm. And that's a really good point. I think the mayor has really misstepped and really been insulting to survivors in one key respect. He has continuously brought up the criminal histories of the accusers as if they were relevant to the truth of these allegations. And I think that that is an insult to survivors. And I think it also can have a silencing effect on people who, you know, are understandably afraid to come forward with allegations because they're not going to be, I mean, it's routine for our sexual assault survivors to be questioned for their lives to be dragged through the mud, their past criminal history to be brought up. And I think that that is really problematic. And I think the mayor should not have done that.
Rob, do you think there's anything wrong with an accused person questioning the credibility of accusers, at least in the way Ed Murray has?
Well, we've seen in the courts for decades rape victims torn down by defense attorneys. And it's a pretty horrible thing to see happen. The credibility of the accuser does come into question, however, because what you have is a situation in some of these cases of, as we said before, he said, you know, one person accuses, the other person denies, there's no other extrinsic evidence. Therefore, you do look to the credibility of each person. Is this person known for telling the truth? Are they credible in that way? And so it's inevitable that the person who's being accused is going to raise those kinds of questions. But it gets to a point where it's really uncomfortable for all of us who are watching, because what happened with this young man, you know, after the events when he was a foster child, doesn't seem to have a bearing on his recollection of the events that occurred when he was a foster child. And what's different now, this is really key, is the records have now been found. I don't know why they disappeared in the state of Oregon, but that corroborating evidence that we didn't have access to before is now on full display. And that changes how people are looking at it. And I think that's why you've seen the calls for the mayor to resign, if for no other reason than for respect for the victims.
So hypothetically, if you found out that, oh, as it turns out, the mayor was completely innocent, just as he said, would you still think it was inappropriate for him to have said, I'm innocent, and hey, well, then these charges are absurd, and so maybe we better start looking at the motives of the people making stuff up about me?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, if you're the mayor of a major city and you have a megaphone and you're out there saying, you know, this person has no credibility because of their criminal past, you have to know that that has a larger impact than just on your individual case. And so if the impact is for other, you know, for survivors to look at that and say, well, I'm not going to come forward because I'm not going to be believed. And who knows, I might get, dragged through the mud in this really public way that's, you know, just going to add to my trauma. It's not worth it. So I think the mayor has to consider his the fact that he has a megaphone, the fact that he's a public figure before he makes statements like that, even if it does turn out that he's completely innocent of all the charges.
Okay, we're going to shift from these allegations. Before I completely leave it, I just want to know, does anyone think that this weird situation of mayoral candidates campaigning to replace somebody in the situation we've been discussing, has that actually seemed to have affected the campaign or who voters want next in the office? I mean, you have candidates making their statements about what they think about, you know, the journalists, as I have, will ask them what you think. But do you think it's had material effect on the mayoral campaign?
I think for people who don't like Jenny Durkin, it has provided some ammunition, because Jenny Durkin has been, you know, was a pretty stalwart supporter of Mayor Murray, got his endorsement before these latest allegations or this latest evidence came out. She has not said that he should resign. She said that due process should play out. And I think that people who don't like her or who are were sort of on the fence, this could be a reason for them to vote against her.
Well, while all this is going on, Mayor Murray did something this week. He jumped into the police reform fight in a new way. He declared unilaterally that police have to wear body cameras. And this is a debate that we've been having in Seattle for years. The police officers union says, you can't just make us wear body cameras. That's part of our contract negotiations. We're bargaining about that right now. Rob, was Murray out of line with this executive order?
I don't think he was, actually. I think that obviously a lot of important requirements need to be collectively bargained with any union for workers. But at the same time, they can be required to carry certain basic equipment already, right? They have to wear their bulletproof vests, for example, to help, you know, keep them safer. So I don't think he was out of line in requiring them to wear the body cameras, given the policy direction that this has been going in, which is more and more we see the value both to the public and to the officers to have them wear them and to have them turned on at all times when they're on duty.
Anybody disagree? I mean, why is it that body? I guess one question for the average, if you don't know anything about union contract negotiations, you might wonder whether police officers ought to make more money for wearing body cameras. Is it a hardship in some kind of way that you want them bargaining?
Well, collective bargaining is over work conditions,
yes,
not just over compensation, and that's what this comes down to. It's a condition of work.
That's true.
And so,
but don't they have a history? Am I wrong about that? The union has a history of getting concessions for any rule change, whether you think that's great or not.
Yeah, I mean, that's a standard tactic of the police union here in Seattle. And I think, you know, they've asked for something like 1.5% pay increase for officers who agree to wear body cameras.
Hmm.
I think if this is an issue of police accountability, it should apply equally to all officers. I don't think that they should be, you know, as Judge Robart put it this week when he refused to move forward with the consent decree. Before the police negotiations wrap up, you know, he said this is blackmail. I think if we need these cameras, then it should be separate from negotiations. If it's part of negotiations, it shouldn't be something that the police union can hold up in favor or in exchange for pay. I also think that we've had examples in the last month or two of instances where police cameras would have really come in handy. The shooting of Charlena Lyles was not recorded on a police camera because the officer wasn't wearing a body camera. So we will never know definitively what happened inside her apartment. It's going to be, you know, another instance where officers say one thing and witnesses say another. If we'd had a body camera, that question would be answered. There was also this case in Baltimore this week.
That Baltimore case.
Yeah.
I shouldn't have been shocked, but go on.
Well, it was like watching an episode of The Wire.
Yes,
right?
It was.
And where the cop was caught on camera because he didn't realize his body camera recorded the 30 seconds prior to turning it on. He was caught on camera planting drugs on a suspect.
Oh,
How a device is on 30 seconds before you turn it on, I don't totally understand, but that's...
Does it know you're about to turn it on? And it says, oh, don't worry, I'm already working.
Right.
Maybe
it's sort of always on, but then retroactively it starts.
Right.
The audio.
It's always running, but not always recording.
Yeah.
It's like Alexa is always listening.
Right.
But
right.
Doesn't actually record anything until she hears you use her name.
And for those who don't know, I mean, really, this guy, it is like TV because you're watching this person. It's very deliberate and very obvious. And the other two, he's plants the drugs in a soup can. And puts it in the debris, and then he walks out with two other officers and then says, okay, well, I guess we better go search. And everybody kind of laughs.
Well, I could really go for some soup right now.
Yeah.
It's
crazy.
Well, I think the thing is that, you know, cops come from, you know, from society just like every other profession. And like every other profession, there are going to be people who are corrupt. There are going to be good people and there are going to be bad people. And the point of body cameras is not to assume the worst about law enforcement officers. It's to catch the ones who are doing the worst and not to assume the best of every cop just because they decide to become a cop.
Phyllis, Erica mentioned the federal judge weighing in and the consent decree, and not all listeners are up to speed. In basics, can you fill us in on what she was talking
about? Well, yeah, I was going to ask Erica something about this because I was really intrigued by his comment, as it was quoted in the paper, about blackmail.
This federal judge, the citizens of Seattle are not going to pay blackmail for constitutional policing.
Yeah, and it just... I thought that it was an interesting comment, and also I'll be really interested to see then now what he was ordering was, I want a list of everything that's still being negotiated. And so Pete Holmes has to turn that over. But typically at this point, it's still confidential what's being negotiated. And so I was interested in what was the deadline for that? Are people speculating about what's on the list? Because it really might not just be money. I don't know.
Well, we don't know. We know that the judge said, I am not, Seattle passed this law, this police accountability law, and this is under this federal court order. Mm-hmm. And this judge said, I'm not ready to go along with this.
Yeah.
Well, does policing have to involve wearing a body camera that's always on in order to be constitutional? That would be a new requirement. It wasn't clear to me from his comment about whether it has any bearing on body cameras in particular, but clearly he's concerned that other key requirements that are constitutionally required not be stalled or upended by collective bargaining requirement. I mean, those are things the city cannot, negotiate away, clearly.
Yeah. Right, right. Okay.
Well, and remember, this is Robard's kind of last bite at the apple because our current attorney general, this process all started back when President Obama was president. Mm-hmm. Our current attorney general has indicated quite clearly that he's going to back off on consent decrees and on police accountability. So this really is the opportunity that that we have, for the next 4 years to get this right. And, and I think Judge Robard admirably is saying we're not going to speed this up. We're not going to do this fast. We're going to do it right.
Mm-hmm.
One thing about body cameras I have to mention, because we were talking about the tragedy involving Ms. Lyles, who was shot, is that it's not a panacea for not just the obvious reason, but, which is that these cameras aren't perfect. But, if the officer doesn't use it, just like the officer didn't have a taser with him, one of the officers was not with a taser, then even the requirement isn't foolproof. But having said that, if they're required to wear them, they're more likely the not will, and then you have the benefit of it. But I think we have to be realistic that it doesn't solve everything either.
Mm-hmm. Well, what do you do with that information, though? So it doesn't solve everything, therefore what?
You require it, but you have to make sure you have adequate training. And there has to be accountability. When I heard that one of the officers involved in the Lyle shooting didn't carry his taser, he hadn't bothered to recharge the batteries, it was sitting in his locker, had been there for a week or 2 weeks. Mm. I thought, okay, that's a problem potentially with training. It's also a problem with accountability. It's like, shouldn't there be repercussions for not going out properly equipped? Mm-hmm. So while they're at it and getting people to make sure the body cameras are functioning and are fully charged, et cetera, let's make sure they carry the other essential equipment as well. Otherwise, we're creating expectations that are going to be disappointed ultimately.
I think also doing this by executive order was something that the mayor, you could say this is also a distraction from his ongoing scandal, which it is, but... this has been going on for 2 years. It's been 2 years since body cameras were recommended, and SPOG, the police union, has been preventing them from happening. And so the question is, how long is this going to happen? If I was the mayor and I wanted to make this happen, I would sure as heck do it before I left office, then wait for whoever the next mayor is to follow up, because the police union has shown every indication that it's just going to delay, delay, delay.
Okay, finally, the police union could, I suppose, file an unfair labor practice claim about the mayor's executive order?
Yeah, potentially they could.
But nobody thinks we're headed towards some kind of police strike, right?
I'm not reading
the order back to work.
I'm not reading that the union is saying no way to body cameras. I think they're negotiating over the conditions. They would like extra compensation for officers that are required to wear them, and that's what unions do. They see an opportunity to get more pay for their members. They're going to try to get it.
Okay.
But I'm not reading the union saying, We will never agree to have our officers wear body cameras. There's enough evidence.
No, the president of the union told me on this show, we went through a trial run, a pilot program of it. We're not against it. We're just doing our bargaining. Let us bargain.
Man, I know what I'd bargain. Less paperwork. Yeah. I got that camera on. Why do I got to write something down?
Hey, there you go.
You know, the ACLU,
just an idea for you.
The ACLU raised an interesting point in one of the articles that we used for this segment about whether officers should be able to look at the camera footage before they write the reports or should be required to write the reports first.
Yeah.
Because they want to know what was they think that if they look at the footage afterwards, it will shape their memory of the events, mm-hmm. which it will. But I thought that was a really interesting point that I hadn't thought of before. And it'll be interesting to see if that, too, becomes a subject of bargain. Do you get to look at the footage when you're writing the report or do you write your report based on your memory, the videotape in your head? And then you look at it later.
And then people will speculate about the motive, right? Are you saying you want to look at that stuff so you get it right in your report, or that you want to look at the footage so that you can see what you can get away with?
Well, it seems like common sense that they should make a report that's as accurate as possible. So if they're allowed to talk to their fellow patrol officer, well, how did you see it before they write the report? I mean, not letting them look at the video footage doesn't seem to be very intuitive.
Interesting. Okay, let's leave that there. That's city business. We're going to talk about a statewide law that kicks in on Sunday. The pulling over is going to start happening.
Dark day, Bill. A dark, dark day.
We'll find out how dark in a moment on the Week in Review. Now, more of KOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke with Phyllis Fletcher, Erica C. Barnett, and Rob McKenna. This week, a Washington State Patrol trooper told me who he's going to start pulling over this weekend. Under the new law that starts on Sunday, you can no longer hold your phone in your hand while you're driving. Now, you already couldn't hold it up to your ear. Now you cannot hold the phone and text or search. Trooper Rick Johnson said you get one touch, one.
I can tell you we're not going to be sitting on the freeway counting people's touches.
Right.
Or the time span between the touches. We don't want you dialing a 10-digit phone number because that is continuous one touches.
Uh-huh. Continuous one touches. It's the stutter touch.
Yeah.
The stutter touch. Continuous one touching is now illegal, even if you're stopped in traffic, even if you're at a light. Also, you could get an extra ticket if you get pulled over for one offense and the officer determines that the reason you offended is that you did some distracted driving. You're putting on makeup, you're shaving, smoking, eating, reading, gazing at yourself, whatever, you can get an extra $99. Will this change anyone's driving here in this room? Do you think you'll change your life because of this new law that starts on Sunday?
I need to. Mm-hmm. I will admit that.
Thank you for your honesty.
I have admitted that on this program before. Yeah. I'm admitting again, I need the nanny state in my life. I need it to do this. And it already
saved me from myself.
Yeah, really. I mean,
and everyone else.
And even last night, I was like, okay, what am I doing tomorrow? The mental list. And I was driving and I was at a stoplight and I was reaching for it.
Yeah.
And I was like, nope.
Yeah.
And I can't say I stopped myself every time.
Yeah, that's the question. You thought about it, but did you still?
I did stop that time. Uh-huh. I did.
Oh, it's the harm reduction model.
Yeah.
I recognize that.
So far.
Yeah.
But I got to say, this is one of those things. If I were at a stoplight and I got pulled over and the body camera was good enough, I'd be cold busted. I'd be paying the $99. I would be busted. So I'm trying to curb my behavior. And as Yoda says, do or do not. There is no try. So I am curbing my behavior there.
Nice, Phyllis. Welcome to the land of the law abiding.
Thank you.
Well, so I don't drive a whole lot.
I know.
Yeah. When I do, I was shocked to learn that eating while driving is illegal.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a secondary offense if you did something wrong because you were eating.
Okay, so are we going to outlaw drive-thrus? I mean, I honestly right. don't understand the logic of how exactly that would work. Mm-hmm. But I would say I don't use my phone when I drive. But I don't drive very much. I use my phone on the bus all the time.
Yeah. How about on your scooter? Are you ever using your phone on your two wheels?
Absolutely never.
Never.
The logistics of that. I mean, you have to have two hands to drive a scooter. I will say,
plus, even if you're stuck in gridlock, you can use your scooter to be getting around it. I think part of it's the frustration of not going anywhere. Like, at least I can be productive on my phone.
Well, technically, sorry to well actually,
okay.
Bill, but technically, you're not allowed to drive between lanes. Although, as I understand it, that is becoming a lot more common.
In some states, it's legal. In California. I was surprised to learn motorcycles drive right up the middle. I think these guys are kamikazes. just strikes me as being extremely risky to drive between two lines of cars, but you see it happen all the time.
But it's a perfect example of, like, if it's, I mean, what you're talking about, harm reduction, if it's legal, people will try to get away with it, and it is dangerous.
Yeah.
If it's illegal, people will think twice about it. And,
right.
And I will say, I was driving in the South recently. I took a long road trip, and I was definitely listening to some podcasts on my phone and flipping through them and not paying attention and not really thinking anything of it because I didn't know what the laws were, but I thought, well, it's the South. There probably aren't any. So I think...
Sorry,
you know.
South.
I'm sorry. Are you from Seattle by chance?
I'm from Mississippi.
There you go.
So,
well, then you do know whereof you speak.
I do. And I learned to drive in Houston.
Oh, wow.
So, okay. You know all the bad habits.
The thing about eating, the secondary fine for distracted eating or whatever it is that a $99 fine is not going to make me eat more carefully. I already eat carefully because I don't want to die and I don't want to kill anyone. So,
or mess up that awesome butterfly shirt.
Yes. Look at the shirt I'm wearing. Are you going to spill ketchup on this?
No.
That would be a crime.
Right? Yes. It would be a crime. So it has made me learn about Siri. I have an iPhone 6 and I've never used Siri, but now I'm learning. I've been dictating texts to my wife.
Oh, good.
But I can't figure out how to reread old texts. I keep telling Siri every way I know how to pull up the text from my friend that I can't remember what he said, or I want to reply, anyway, my point is I'm not as productive under the new law as I was
before.
She
never listens.
Siri doesn't listen. She doesn't care.
No, probably
not. I think a lot of us are going to be using the voice commands more.
Yep.
If we need to make a call a lot of cars now have voice commands too to operate the radio, and they have controls right on the steering wheel, so they are getting safer. The best thing about the car I drive is it has a heads up display on the windshield, so I can see if I have nav running, I can see the direction.
Or
the next direction, and I can see the speed limit and my speed, all that. But ultimately the solution here is clear. It's artificial intelligence so that your phone.
I thought you were going to say transit, Rob.
Actually, the truth is that you made me think is I drive a lot less now because I moved to less than 3 miles away from my office. And so being in the car 10 minutes or not using the car at all is actually the best solution of all. But I think AI is the way of the future. That way, Bill, your phone will already know. And it'll just call the AI system on the other person's phone, and they can just talk and figure it out.
Like a wire transfer from my brain.
Pretty much.
Okay.
I want to mess with somebody right now. Huh. Alexa, call Austin Jenkins.
Done.
Burn.
Done. this is also, you brought up, this is a matter of privilege, because you have a car with a heads-up nav display or whatever, but my 2000... Camry and I have to buy a cradle. Like, is the state going to get a kickback from the car phone cradle industry, from Big Cradle? Because I now owe them money, whether I want to or not.
Well, with more than 150 people dying in distracted driving accidents in our state last year, and a reversal of a long-term decline in traffic fatalities because of distracted driving, I think this was an inevitable step. The second thing is, fortunately, even features that are initially are only available in high-end cars. Remember anti-lock brakes? You could initially only get them on like some high-end Mercedes.
Oh yeah,
they are commonplace now. Backup cameras are going to be mandated on cars, so that actually does.
Oh, I find those way more distracting than just looking.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah? Mm-hmm. But are they more accurate?
It eliminates the blind spot. You have to still look over your shoulder, too, but it eliminates
old
the blind
school.
Spot.
All the way.
Old school.
Old school. Besides, she's jealous because her scooter doesn't have one yet.
Aww.
Okay,
turning around.
We joke about the distracted driving and the shaving, which I'm going to have to either stop doing. But no, I'm just going to shave carefully to save $99. I don't swerve when I shave. I'm good at it. But thank you, Rob. We kid, but that obviously the premise is that's a serious, serious issue, and the law's about to change.
Mm-hmm.
There's a grace period. You're not going to get ticketed for at least, I think it's until January, but they might pull you over and give you a talking to.
Don't tell me that.
Sorry, Phyllis. Okay. You got until January. This week we are giving Bike Share, speaking of the roads, we're giving Bike Share another shot in Seattle. Bike Share, of course, means a company owns bicycles that you can find all over the city. You got to get somewhere, you pick up a bike, you pay for it, you ride it, you get where you're going, you leave it for the next person. Seattle had a Bike Share called Pronto, but not enough people used it.
Mm.
Was that because Seattle's too hilly, too rainy, too dark, too dangerous? Or were we just doing it wrong? This week, two new companies started pilot programs. They're called Lime Bike and Spin.
We're not going to get everyone out of cars, and we're not trying to. What we're trying to offer is a viable alternative such that when you need to make that trip from Belltown to City Hall, you have an option. And biking's not for everyone. It's not going to be a one-size-fits-everyone solution, but I think it will add value to the city in a city that desperately needs more transportation mobility.
So here's the difference with the new bike shares. With Pronto, you had to pick up and return your bike at designated stations. Lime Bike and Spin have no stations. Your bike could be anywhere. It could be on the roof. You just have to locate it with your app, and you unlock it by scanning your phone, and after you ride it, you're supposed to park it someplace responsible. Mm. So does anyone think that bike share ridership is going to go up compared to Pronto?
From what we've seen, this is a pilot project that hasn't been done on this scale by this type of company ever before. I would sort of like Seattle to occasionally try things that have been tried before, because it's questionable whether 500 bikes citywide, which is what each company is starting with, is going to contribute to the transportation system in a way that, like, people can predictably know that they can use a bike, which mm-hmm. is part of the problem with allowing them everywhere instead of having fixed stations. The problem that I saw with Pronto is there weren't enough stations and they weren't densely populated enough so that they were, you know, it wasn't reliable in that way. This system kind of has the opposite problem, which is that you can't plan ahead to use a bike on your lunch break or get to an appointment or get to a meeting, because with 500 bikes in the whole city, who knows if there's going to be one within walking distance. Another problem is that, unlike Pronto, they don't provide helmets. So you have to have your own helmet with you or bike at your own risk. So say I want to go from Belltown to City Hall. I think that was Gabriel Scheer talking.
Yeah, that's right, from Lime Bike.
From Lime Bike. The problem is I would have to bring a helmet with me to work in the morning and have it with me on the bus or in my car, wherever, and prepare in that way. And I don't know that people are going to do that. I think that the problem is our helmet law, and in the absence of getting rid of that law, this kind of presents an even bigger problem than Pronto did, because Pronto had those little machines that would dispense helmets for you.
Oh. Right.
Which I am on record as saying I find kind of gross.
Because what, cooties from other people who've used
cooties.
The helmet?
Ugh. Oh, biker cooties.
Biker funk.
Yeah.
Yeah. Who? Anybody else? Think about the biker funk.
One thing you can say about this is it's not going to cost taxpayer money. In fact, the city will collect a fee, $9,300, I think, for the first 500 bikes.
So the city was spending money on Pronto.
Yeah, and it's capital. You know, it's capital intensive. So as I understand it, one of the ideas these people have who are trying this, and there are several companies with venture funding that are competing, is that they don't have the capital costs associated with building building the docking stations. So I think that has merit. I think whether the bikes end up in places people can actually find them instead of turning into some sort of elaborate scavenger hunt to find them is another question.
You're just supposed to, you know, don't put it in the middle of the sidewalk. Don't put it, you know.
Well, what if you ride it, leave freelance. It someplace really obscure, I guess, is one of the questions.
Well, yeah, how specific is your phone? How can your phone app find the bike wherever it is? I don't know.
Well, supposedly it's supposed to be kind of like, I mean, I don't know if they've made this comparison, but like Car2Go or Reach Now, the car services, which are pretty reliable. But so far, I've heard a lot of glitches reported with the Spin bikes, at least, that people are looking for them and they're not where they say they're going to be. I assume that's something that can be worked out within the app, but yeah.
Well, and also that if this is successful, you'll have thousands of them, because 500 will be the starting point from one company. More companies will come in, they'll increase the number of bikes. So obviously the more bikes that are added to the system, the less that becomes a problem.
Well, there's also, I mean, you were talking about privilege, and there's an equity issue here, which is that you have to have a smartphone. Mm-hmm. And not everybody has smartphones still to this day. I know it's hard to believe in this room where we all like have our iPhones sitting out on the table, but but if you don't have a smartphone, you won't be able to access these bikes. Yeah. And one of them, the Spin bike, and again, this is something that could be fixed, but they have three speeds. And you want to talk about hills, you can't get up a hill. You can't get up even, you know, a modest hill like Pine
Speak
Tree.
Speak for yourself.
Oh, these bikes are great. They're built of steel. Oh, wait a minute.
Yeah, I mean, they're indestructible. And, you can get a heavy bike up a hill if it has enough speeds that you can just kind of lean back and go slow. But three speeds, that's pretty tough, you know, even for a pretty experienced and strong biker.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if you dibs? Like, if I'm, like, sitting in KUOW right now and I'm like, oh, at 45th and University, there's one of these bikes. Like, might it be gone by the time I get out there? Or can I be like, Bogart?
Good question.
That's a good question. I haven't used this service, but I would... Car2Go lets you put a hold on a car for 30 minutes.
Okay. Yeah,
so I would assume that they would have a similar. If they don't, they should.
Yeah, right. Okay.
I did fire up the Lime Bike app. I was I was open to using it, and I couldn't find one near me. Mm. And I just opened it this morning, opened the app. It said there are currently no bikes in this area. We'll let you know when Lime Bike becomes available here. And I'm in the U District. You know, it's a pretty dense. I haven't tried the Spin app. I've seen more bikes on the app, the Spin app, than I've seen on the Lime Bike, but who knows? Maybe they're still ramping up.
You know what it reminds me of? One of these, I can't remember which one, but one did a pilot project in Austin, and I lived in Austin for a long time, many years ago, and it reminds me of the Yellow Bike Project.
Oh.
I don't know if anybody remembers that, or if it was something that existed. I think it existed in other cities too, but there were just these bikes everywhere that people, volunteers painted yellow, and you could just pick one up.
Oh yeah,
take it wherever,
I've heard of that.
And leave
all
it
of them
wherever.
Were at the bottom of hills.
Well,
I'm guessing.
Austin does have hilly parts, but there are some good straightaways between the university and downtown.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Otherwise, you need volunteers in vans carrying lugging the bikes back up the hill.
And they might have had it. I mean, it was a pretty cool little DIY program, and it was free.
Aww.
How many ended up in the river? I'm just wondering.
You know, I'll look back in the archives,
right,
the Austin Chronicle, and tell you.
Okay, that's Bike Share in Seattle. A couple of companies are trying it out. It's a pilot program from Spin and Lime Bike. And as Rob said, there could be others. We'll see how successful it is as Seattle takes another run at it. Yes.
And I just have breaking news here. There are no holds on the bikes, I'm told.
Oh, okay. Oh, thank you for, nice response.
That kind of makes sense. Yeah. I mean, the idea is you just walk out with your app and find the nearest bike. It would be a little more stilted to have them all be bought up to be reserved.
Yeah.
But who knows?
Yeah.
But that also can make it less convenient.
Like, if you walk down the street and you just want to do it, then you could do it.
Yep.
But then you can't really, like Eric was saying, plan. Yeah.
Okay, we plan to discuss the newest power couple in Seattle and a couple other bits of news on the Weekend Review, so stay tuned. Erica C. Barnett and Rob McKenna and Phyllis Fletcher, and I'm Bill Radke. Seattle has a new power couple. This is our Jay-Z and Beyonce. This is our Sue Bird, the star of the Seattle Storm, WNBA basketball champion, won the finals, Olympic gold medalist. She came out as gay this week, and she's dating Megan Rapinoe, Olympic gold medalist, star of the Seattle Reign soccer team. Phyllis, who cares? Does this matter?
Yeah, I think it's cool. I mean, I just like these moments as a cultural marker, even though I'm not Sporty Spice.
Uh-huh.
You know, I mostly know about these gals from my colleagues and friends who follow sports more closely. But I'm happy for her, you know, that she was able to do this on her terms and just say, yeah, this is me. You know, my friends know this is just my deal. I think that's great. And I know it's still not like that for everyone, but I like seeing those moments happen and seeing people be happy. I think it's rad.
Yeah, there's a mark of progress that if it had not been for the double announcement, the Megan Rapinoe announcement, if it had just been, oh, Sue Bird's gay, honestly, I don't think I would have thought about it for a moment, you know,
right,
because what is the big deal? But come on, now the two athletes, two of the greatest athletes in the country in their respective sports.
Mm-hmm.
That's
fresh.
That's news. That's fresh.
Yeah.
Bill, you're looking at me.
Yeah.
And as I'm like over here in flop sweats, I'm like, I don't follow sports. But I do.
You don't have to follow sports to weigh in.
Well, I'm with Phyllis. I think it's cool. I think it's a really a cultural marker of Seattle as a city that, you know, that we are this progressive city with, you know, we don't have our Sonics, but we have a very, you know, successful and progressive pro basketball team. And, you know, Storm has, this is how into sports I am. I briefly forgot the name of the team. I apologize. The Storm recently did, a couple days ago, a fundraiser for Planned Parenthood.
Right.
You know, and so, I mean, I think, you know, for a sports team to sort of wear its progressivism on its arm, and I'm not saying that Sue Bird was making a political statement by, you know, by coming out. This is just, you know, her saying, this is who I am. But the fact that, you know, we have a city where that is something that a sports star can comfortably do, that we're, you know, going to get excited and, you know, aw.
It is kind of like that. Aww.
Yeah, it's really, I mean, I think it really, at a time when, you know, this city is so divided and there's, you know, there's this mayoral scandal, everybody is fighting over the mayor's race. It's nice to have a little bit of good news that everybody can just kind of celebrate and it doesn't become some, you know, giant controversy.
I think it underscores what a lot of people have felt for a long time, which is Sue Bird is the classiest or one of the very classiest pro athletes in Seattle and has been for a long time.
But why does this underscore her classiness?
For me, it does. It does that because she went public on her own terms when she thought it was the right time.
Well, why is that classy? I mean, meaning nobody outed her against her will?
Well, I just mean that she has always been an athlete who, you know, is modest. She embodies the best attributes of sports, which is, you know, being, you know, sportsmanlike, man-like, right? But sportsmanlike conduct. She's talented. She doesn't grandstand. She's not seeking the limelight. I mean, you know what happens? A lot of younger athletes, and I'll say male athletes, often get caught up in the limelight, and they do things that end up are a little embarrassing or uncomfortable, you know, screaming at their coaches on the sidelines or saying things afterwards, criticizing their team or things in their personal lives. And Sue Bird has just been always really classy. And I thought she was a class act before this happened, but I thought, wow, she really handled this in an impressive way because it was on her terms, her timing, and her girlfriend is super impressive. So you got to give points for that.
Mm-hmm.
She said that she told ESPN, that's how the article that in which she came out, she says, I was never tormented within myself. You know, mm-hmm. She said it was a non-issue. Someone who had castigated her said I would have been like, fine, goodbye. Mm-hmm. And she was filling out a magazine questionnaire last summer, 25 things you don't know about Olympians. And she says, quote, I literally had at number 25, I'm gay. And then I just didn't do it. I chickened out.
Hmm. Yeah, I noticed that too. And yeah, if I were doing the public radio interview, I'm sure I would probe on that and be like, why? But really, it's like, it's not even really for me to ask, you know,
right.
That's her deal. And, you know, I'm just happy for her. That's rad.
She did come in for an interview with me
about a
couple of months ago. And I'm, you know, I'm a bit of a fan. She's Sue Bird. So I texted a friend of mine, hey, guess who I met today? And he wrote back and said, oh, she's gay. I said, what? And he said, yeah, she got a Golden Girls t-shirt on. What? And so I looked it up, and sure enough, apparently, LGBT Golden Girls, it's a thing.
Yeah.
Which I just learned.
Yeah, that knowledge came to me slowly.
I don't know if it's a coincidence.
Yeah.
I don't know why she was wearing a shirt. I have no idea. I just found
right.
out a piece of information.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think that every gay person in my life on some level loves the Golden Girls, and so do I. I mean, they're amazing. You know, like, you carry your purse from room to room in your own house. That's intelligence.
Well, I think it's interesting. You know, your friend was like, oh yeah, she's gay.
Uh-huh.
And I think, you know, worth noting is that she didn't have to come out. I mean, she doesn't have any responsibility to the public to say, you know, one way or another.
That's
you know,
right.
I think there's lots of celebrities that everybody is like, oh yeah, he's gay or she's gay. But I think it's also a sign of progress that we aren't, you know, I mean, maybe it's not a sign of progress. Maybe she felt pressure. I don't know.
Yeah.
But that, you know, we aren't, you know, as inclined to put pressure on people to say, you know, well, what are you?
Right.
Because it's nobody's business.
Yeah.
In fact, she told ESPN that Sue Bird doesn't like to be the topic of conversation. So maybe we should stop talking about
her.
Get on with her life. KOW's. What's that?
We're big fans, though. So.
We are. We are at KOW tweeting, so please join us. I'm sure there's much, much discussion. And we've got a couple more sort of big items of the week to react to when we come back. So stay tuned. I told you we're tweeting at KUOW, our social media producer, Kara McDermott. Was this something that someone tweeted, or you were just boiling yourself while you were listening to us talk?
I will admit, I have a little boil point over here because I am the sporty spice in the room, I think.
You played a lot of soccer.
And I just want to put it on record. We did not mention this in Megan Rapinoe's intro, but she is also a World Cup champion.
I said Olympic champion, but to
also
a,
true.
Yes, but to a soccer fan, World Cup, bigger deal. Mm. Maybe?
Well, I don't think we need to start that argument.
Okay, okay.
I will say yes.
It deserves a place in there. Yeah. Okay, Megan?
Some things are just too controversial for the show.
Yes, just too hot. Megan and Sue, please come in together and talk to us on KUOW.
Yeah.
We're with Phyllis Fletcher, Erica C. Barnett, and Rob McKenna. And just I wanted to see if you had any take on a couple other newsy things that happened just today. Sean Spicer, we've used the word sporty spice, I think, twice now. And the Spicy himself just quit. Sean Spicer has been President Trump's press secretary. That's a tough assignment. Saturday Night Live has been mocking him for yelling and lying.
Right.
In a gift of a performance from Melissa McCarthy. Did he get forced out? We don't know. The New York Times quotes anonymous sources saying he doesn't like his new boss, the White House communications director, financier Anthony Scaramucci. And this is the new guy, Mr. Scaramucci, describing his boss.
But here's what I tell you about the president. He's the most competitive person I've ever met. Okay, I've seen this guy throw a dead spiral through a tire. I've seen him at Madison Square Garden with a top coat on. He's standing in the key and he's hitting foul shots and swishing them. Okay, he sinks 3-foot putts. I don't see this guy as a guy that's ever under siege. This is a very, very competitive person.
He sinks 3-foot putts, you know.
Who says top coat?
My dad used to say that.
Now, if you could do it with a top hat, I'd be really impressed.
It sounds like President Trump's new communication director is President Trump himself.
Right.
I mean, they really seem like twins. I think he was being asked about the president being, quote unquote, under siege. I think it was his way of saying, hey, nothing ruffles.
Okay,
this,
so he
this
wasn't
leader.
Being literal, because that would be insane. I'm just checking, though.
Just
was
letting
he?
Us know.
Okay.
I think he was saying he's a competitive guy.
Okay.
He's going to win. He's going to win even though you're all against it.
Okay.
So that's the new communications director.
So fun fact about Scaramucci, he was, I was just reading an old Washington Post story this morning that I posted on Twitter. He was the guy who, or one of the guys who was peddling the false flag accusations that Jewish community centers were bombing or were threatening themselves with bomb threats. If you go to my Twitter page, there's a link. It's at Erica C. Barnett. I have been discovered by the alt-right, which is always fun. It happens from time to time.
And they gently and lovingly corrected you on some
and lovingly
small matter?
Bombard me with examples that they say prove that Jewish people are throwing up false flags and pretending that anti-Semitism exists. So I would encourage people to, if they're interested, go read that article.
Rob, did you have your own personal spokesman when you were Attorney General?
You know, you always have someone in a big organization who the press can reach and talk to.
Uh-huh.
And typically, we would have prepared statements that would go out as opposed to someone we would put in front of the microphone. So most government agencies don't have someone like a Sean Spicer who holds press conferences. That's for the White House and maybe a few other really high offices. But organizations of any size in government will typically have a public information officer who interfaces with the media, writes things that can be released. You know, for me, it was Dan Sitman, who had been in broadcasting before and did a great job for me, and he worked for a communications director. So,
Did any part of you sympathize with Sean Spicer just because you were a public official and sometimes you had to communicate with the public a lot? And
it's a tough job, and that's the toughest audience ever for journalists, right? That crowd. So I've had sympathy for White House spokespeople for many years because it's a really hard job, but there's no denying that Spicer made the job harder, made it harder on himself in the way he conducted it. So I'm glad he's leaving, if only for his own mental health, and so we don't have to watch him have an aneurysm on camera, which seemed like the way it was heading. But it does raise the crucial question, which is which Saturday Night Live performer will impersonate Sarah Huckabee? That's what I want to know.
That's the new on-camera person. Well, not new. She's been doing it, but she's got the job.
But they're not doing anything on camera anymore, so that may be...
Yeah, right. There's no on-camera news conferences anymore.
Right.
And finally, O.J. Simpson's going to be a free man in about 3 months. He got paroled yesterday from a Nevada prison. He was there not for killing his ex-wife and her friend, but for helping rob some memorabilia dealers of stuff he says was his. And my gut reaction was, O.J. Simpson's been denying these murders for 20 years. It's been him against the world. And now someone has shown him grace by letting him out early. And I imagine that giving him the psychic space to let down and say, I did it. Am I crazy? Mm-hmm. Am I crazy?
He's never going to admit it.
I don't think.
No way.
No. No. Even his book was called If I Did It, right? Like...
That was a while ago. I'm saying he's trying to wrap things up here at the twilight of his life.
Are you kidding? I mean that ESPN was it ESPN the third? It was 30.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
30 by 30, whatever it's called. Yeah. I'm sorry, you guys. I'm not into sports.
Yeah. We get that.
But the documentary series about him, he hasn't had a chance to respond to that. I'm sure he wants to. I mean, I can see him writing another book. Doubling down on his denial of of his obvious guilt.
Now he can get back to looking for the real killers, right?
Right. Oh, yeah. Sure. Mm-hmm. And I really like Stephen Colbert's response, which was, if he's such a model prisoner, why don't they let him stay in there?
To be a model for everyone else?
Exactly.
Yeah, maybe that really suits him.
So he's moving to Florida, apparently. That's what he says. He doesn't have a place to live there. I agree with you, Eric. I think that he will not be able to resist the limelight. He's going to want to try to make money, which is super creepy. He has an outstanding civil judgment against him for $33.5 million.
But think of the money he could make with the big announcement like LeBron James, set everybody up to sponsor it, and I'm going to make a big announcement.
There is no statute of limitations for homicide, but there is the concept of double jeopardy. So interesting what legal position is in if he did come out and say, oh yeah, I did it after all, ha ha.
Is he in legal? You're saying he is in legal jeopardy if he admits it?
I haven't looked at the double jeopardy question. He was tried and acquitted on the charges of murdering Nicole Brown Simpson and the other individual. The poor guy.
Ron Goldman.
Yeah, the boyfriend?
Friend.
Mm-hmm. So, I don't...
You didn't watch this documentary, did you?
So what's the conclusion? No, I didn't. What is the conclusion of the documentary?
Sports. Is he... O.J. made in America.
Could they ever... prosecute him again under principles of double jeopardy or not?
Honestly, we'll all have to watch. I was reliving the 90s, so I did not get the fine legal points.
Okay.
We'll have a viewing party together. We've been talking with Rob McKenna, who was the attorney general in this here state, so he knows stuff about double jeopardy and stuff, but not everything. And Erica C. Barnett, who blogs at thecisforcrank.com, and she tweets as well, like you were telling us.
At Erica C. Barnett.
Erica C. Barnett. It's an informative Twitter feed.
Mm-hmm.
And the managing editor of the Northwest News Network. Oh, we didn't even get into the fact that there's no capital budget in this state.
It's all messed up, but you'll hear about it later on KUOW 94.9.
Give me 10 seconds. Why is there no... Are they still in session?
No, they are. They have adjourned. Yeah.
The adjourn with no capital budget.
A bunch of stuff is not going to happen.
Okay.
Unless they get called back.
And this is what you the people who work for you do.
Yes.
They cover this and they explain
Absolutely.
It to us. We'll do that next week.
By the way, the interwebs tell me that O.J. Simpson cannot be charged again because of double jeopardy.
Okay.
Bill Radke's looking right.
I found one article
mark
already.
My words.
It must be right. It's on the internet.
It's on your phone. Yep.
Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you again next week.